Are you ready?
Just to pick up, we were talking about Lee. Things are beginning to relate to each other. And it's an activity based on contemplation. So the emphasis more, I think, on the activity that is contemplated than an activity that's, you know, like going out and building something. This next part, which is why I took a break so you could have a fresh mind, it's just, I think it's an interesting comment on the role of community for creative people. And he says, after subject and object assume mutual relationships, so that's been the first three stages, right? Mutual service in fellowship follows. Because of this, all things are nourished and become complete in life. Now, if you think of this in Pali, how this experience was meant to bring him into a new relationship with the human community is also important. But just for our own interest, I think it's a beautiful passage. Completeness of life is only possible in fellowship. No man can complete an enterprise alone and unassisted. The completion of any task demands such fellowship. The artist, too, needs the community to complete a work of art. Indeed, he perhaps more than anyone else. But fellowship does not necessarily mean that we associate with neighbor X or neighbor Y, in whose company we might find ourselves. Rather, fellowship can extend over centuries and millennia. And even if no one in our immediate environment offers such fellowship, nothing should prevent us from reaching back centuries or millennia into the past. There we can always find a stimulating relationship of fellowship, by means of which a given task can be completed. Confucius, during the time of his greatest loneliness, lived in just such fellowship with the Duke of Chao, although he was separated from him by five centuries.
Wow.
Beautiful.
Isn't that sort of like you think Pauli might not have taken the chance because of the loneliness?
Yeah.
It would have, you know.
I think that's a big part of it.
Affirming that, yeah, it might be lonely in your lifetime, but.
And there were plenty of people he could have shared with there. Not a big crowd, but there were some very special people there who would have welcomed him, you know.
Do you suppose he might have tried Michelle and been poo-pooed by the very scientific types?
He would have been annihilated by the scientific community.
So he would be with another community.
Yeah. I was thinking of Jung and friends.
That
fellowship, yeah.
But he did a lot to ruin those relationships.
He did everything he could to ruin those relationships. Just insulted them. And could understand why they weren't interested.
What was the word you used after subject and object have the very, very first?
After subject and object assume a mutual relationship. So first is the object, second stage is the subject, and the third is the beginning of the relationship between the two of them, and the fourth is the need for a fellowship to complete the work.
What time?
I think you were saying that he pushed away.
All of Jung and his friends.
Oh.
But didn't he do that with his fellow scientists as well?
Blow off and stomp out.
They put up with it. Because he was, I think, a brilliant teacher. I guess he was a very boring lecturer, but as you know, the interaction between himself and his mentor, that's where he was valued.
That happens a lot in academia.
Yeah, and there's many things I love about Europe, but one of the things that it's a problem there is that their university professors are boring as hell. They're gods. All they do, the word for lecture in German is literally translated to read in front of. They sit up there and they read. Mm. And they have no relationship to the students. You get 500 people in a lecture hall, maybe. And I was talking with my French teacher who taught in Germany. She must have taught French in Germany and the university there. And she said the rector called her in and said, these 350 people that are in your class, I want 150 of them out the first year. That's the way it works. Very competitive and very authoritarian. Not authoritarian, but expert student. if you happen to survive that long enough to get to know these people, and you're among the elite, which is in a way what the Jung Institute was, then you get this wonderful one-on-one contact. But that maybe, you know, 0.1% of the people get. And that is really what makes a professor well-known, is that the subsequent generation of teachers respect him. That's kind of how the European system works. So he was well-respected by those maybe 10 people in the world. Oppenheimer would have been one of them, you know. That he taught personally, and then worked with creatively, and brought out the best in them. It's a weird system.
It's true in France too.
Oh, I think it's probably true all over, at least North and Central Europe. Yeah, I know. One of my teachers went over there, and the butler was thinking about establishing, I guess, another exchange program. Rouen, I think. Rouen. My teacher went over to see, and she said, "You know, I don't know if I want to put these kids over there because you take a class and there's 300 people in the class. There's no personal, and you know, professors don't know your name, they don't care about you, and their job is to get you out of there if they can. They want to get half the population down in the first year, flunk you out."
What about med school?
Yeah. Well, no, I think med school really does, once you're in. I got a friend who's in med school now, and once you're in, they have an investment.
And
you got to work, but they
used to say that about med school.
Oh, did they?
But I mean, I'm thinking of Harvard, particularly.
Maybe.
If they really work to get on that.
Well, yeah, but I think now it's so expensive. They don't even want to waste a year of training.
Well, they must. The only thing is that they overaccept.
Maybe. I know her experience is different, but who could? It's.
Is that here?
No, it's in the University of Vermont.
Oh.
I don't know what the norm is. But anyway, that's what Pally was like as a teacher, because that's the way the system is. How do we get off on that?
I asked a question.
Oh, what was the question?
Didn't
he push away his students? Yeah.
Or all of his relationships.
Yeah, and I think he was obnoxious to his closest students, but they knew this is a chance in a lifetime to be taught by somebody who will guarantee me a position at Harvard or Yale or University of Chicago, that they put up with
it.
So they put up with it, yeah. Yeah. And I think he was, at that level, probably was a good teacher, so they were putting up with it for good reason. There's that Victor Weisskopf, do you know him? He was one of the guys that worked at Los Alamos. He told a story that, give you an idea what Pally was like, that Pally invited him to be his assistant. And so he went over there to Zurich and knocked on the door, and Pally was working at his desk and said, "Wait till I'm finished." So it worked about a half an hour, and the guy was standing there. And he says, "Who are you?" And Weisskopf said, "I'm Mr. Victor Weisskopf." And Pally says, "Oh, I really wanted Hans Bethe. But for some reason you got chosen." I forget how he said it. So he said, here's the calculation, get lost and work on it." So Weisskopf worked on it for a couple of weeks, he said, brought it back to Pally. Pally pretty says, "Yep, I wish you would have taken Bethe." That's the kind of guy it was. Pretty harsh. But they put up with it because he would teach them things that, I mean, at this time in history, probably 10 people understood this theory. So you either got it there or you didn't get it. Heisenberg was in Germany, so, you know, that was during the war. They weren't going to go there. And Bohr was probably too old to really do any teaching anymore. So that's who he was. Tui. Now, so that went through the fourth stage, which was Kun, doesn't matter. But now Tui is the hexagram below what below the fire, below Li. And this is the fifth stage, as he describes it. And that here is described as joy. He says, "We now have reached evening with its very interesting contrast to morning. The daily work is in the process of being concluded. All productive work requires joy." There are frictions and all sorts of difficulties, but after this dust has disappeared, everything at last will radiate joy. Then only will the work show itself as productive. And if we link that up with the, remember it meant reflection as he talked about it before, that it must mean a willing acceptance and reflection on the experience. And that is what is necessary to make this process fruitful. That's the only way I can put those two together. But if you can remember, the top was fire as an event and as the beginning of linking between the subject and object. That's what we've got out of this so far. And the bottom is the reflection, the clearness of the lake and the spreading of the vapor on the one hand, and on the other hand, it must be that that is carried out in a move of acceptance. That's how I put it together. The next phases are more just for our information because we've discussed the two hexagrams here. The next hexagram is the creative. That's hexagram, sixth hexagram. And what he says there is the work of the day is done. With pleasure and joy, things have been concluded. But now the question arises, has this day been of productive value or was it pretty emptiness? A creative answer is demanded. That's the sixth stage. Seventh stage is that the what has accomplished accumulates in the unconscious and produces dreams.
Could you explain how something, if you accomplish something, it accumulates in the unconscious?
Well, I think if you put it in our language, that you watch the reaction from the unconscious to what you've just done. That, and I'm sure you know when you start doing a creative project, your dreams respond. Your dreams act differently. At least mine sure do. Because you're putting energy into life in line with the creative instinct, and that just activates the unconscious in response to give a commentary on it. I think that's what he's driving at here.
Does that imply that this activity is coming from consciousness?
No, I don't think so.
I guess it comes from the unconscious. You do it a certain way, and then the unconscious responds to how you worked with it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
What's that called?
This is the seventh, which is the Khan, K-A-N, the abysmal. Whatever has been given shape on the surface now collects in the treasure house of dreams. There it will be effective as a dream, be shaped, and then assume the form in which it is conveyed into self-consciousness. The last hexagram is Ken, keeping still, which means the extinction of yesterday and the preparation for tomorrow. So it's a cleansing of the previous. Well, that's it. I think for our purposes, the main point was to see, try to get a sense that Li and Tui are part of a process. And Louis is Lee is fire and relationship. The fire that leads into relationship. And the bottom one is the reflection on that. The lake. which leads to your idea dispersing around the world, so to speak. And that is, should be carried out in an attitude of contentment. That, you know, oh, I'm on the right track here, let's reflect on this. That's how I understand it.
You said acceptance earlier. I mean, acceptance and contentment seem not exactly odd, but, you know, I don't want to parse this too closely. I like what you say about acceptance, because he says it requires joy. Productive work requires joy.
Mm-hmm.
Which you said was, you suggested, was an attitude of acceptance.
Yeah.
But that acceptance isn't necessarily contentment, is it?
Well, it wouldn't have to be, but I think here that's the idea.
That's what you want to call it.
Acceptance, what would be another word? Coming to terms with, feeling that you've come to terms with, or feeling this is the right way to go. You know, there may be a difficult task ahead, but you've gotten your stimulus, and that kind of doubt is gone, and you're willing to accept where you have to go.
Okay.
Surrender.
Yeah.
Surrendering to what is.
Yeah. And what will be. Yeah. And what will be out of what is.
Mm-hmm.
Now put that into Pali. I think that'll help you envision a little bit what's going on in him.
Well, no surrender.
There's no surrender, but that's what I think. That's, he had trouble with the fire, and he had trouble with the reflection, both.
And really, when you get to that place, which is no easy task at all,
no easy task,
there is contentment that comes, even in spite of how difficult, you know, it's
mm-hmm.
going to be.
Maybe a good word here is meaning.
Mm-hmm.
You feel the meaning that, well, it may not be totally pleasurable, but that you're not wasting your life.
Gary, if you were compartmentalized, it would be very difficult for him to reflect on
mm-hmm.
what he was experiencing,
mm-hmm.
especially if those parts weren't talking to each other or communicating on an unconscious level.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see why
it's sad. What's so ironic is, I think, and where we can profit, is I always want to kind of bring this out of just talking about Pali for your sake, because you might start thinking, well, why do I care about this jerk? But if you can see that, remember, all these dreams are coming to him because he said, where have we gone wrong? And the dreams are telling him where we've gone wrong. We're compartmentalized. We are running from affect. We do not reflect on passion. We do not speak the standpoint of the stranger. And he can't get it. He's getting his answer, and he can't understand it. But we can. You know, that beautiful, I don't know if you remember the Hera read, and I think it's Archetypes in the Collective Unconscious. Jung tells the story of the dream of the white and the black magician. I never remember reading that. Well, it's a dream he says it's a dream of a young theologian, and it's about a white and a black magician, and it's like everything is reversed. The white magician causes trouble, and the black magician, who is evil, finds the treasure, and it's quite an involved dream. And then Jung says, and there was no way that guy could understand that dream. So I asked myself, why would you send that dream to somebody who can't listen? And he thought, oh, but I'm listening.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the attitude we have to take. We're listening.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the value of the material.
So would you please review what you said, what's gone wrong right after that? There were four things. Well, so where have we gone wrong?
Oh, well, just think of the themes that are coming up, the compartmentalization, not really dealing with affect, not really dealing with fire, passion, not reflecting on it, compartmentalization, I think, and the stranger, and then within the stranger, this whole notion that there are two dimensions to time. There's the timed, and then there's the transcendental, if you will, this place where our identity lives beyond time and space. All of these things that the dreams are throwing at him, I take to be answers to the question. And they, for me, just set our work, you know. What is my relationship to fire? What is my relationship to reflection? Do I compartmentalize? Do I accept life's rhythm? Do I know what is written on the other side in my stars? What is being asked of me? What should I talk about? What lectures should I be giving? And so on. That's how I am able to stay interested in this material. Take it as almost, it's our, his dreams are our dream. Our dreams. And then ask ourselves where we stand there. Because on one hand, remember, he was a pretty well-functioning individual. I mean, from the point of view of collective, highly regarded professionally, and, you know, certainly capable of, I mean, people didn't take advantage of him. You know, he really could navigate in the world quite successfully. So his dreams are not just helping correct an ego that's off kilter. They're talking about where our civilization has gone wrong, I feel. Hence the value of looking at them. Okay, then we go to 53. Try to see if I can make this a little simpler than it's put in the book here. Basically, he gets interested in the history of Arthurian legend. Which, if you remember, actually came out of France. Because at that time, Brittany was settled by English who had fled the Anglo-Saxon invasion and settled in northwestern France. So it's this weird mixture of English psychology and French psychology, and a lot of it, the original stuff, was in the French language. Basically, he became interested in a story of three spindles. I don't know if we need to worry about all the details. Perhaps the important sentence is about halfway down. In the story, Galahad sleeps with the three spindles in his bed before he sees the secret of the Grail and dies. Which means that these three spindles are part of the journey to selfhood. That's what we have to deal with on the journey to selfhood. And the three spindles would be the lower trinity. I think that's the main idea. He quotes Meyer saying that some of these spindles can have a negative effect. In other versions, the spindles have a negative effect, which I would just take to mean if you're not up to the challenge of the lower trinity, it will have a negative effect. And so Pali related that to the three sticks on the ground. Remember when the stranger went in the, or when the guy went in the river. That's all. It's just an amplification. But it does set the stage for the next dream. That's why I talked about it on page 54. This is not so easy. Oh, sorry to confuse you, but just before, I forgot to mention one detail. On the last dream, he doesn't get to read the manuscript.
Is that dream 13?
Dream 14. I didn't put a... Sorry, I didn't put a... dream 14, 6 November 1949 should be there. Bottom of page 51.
1944?
Dream 14, okay. And then 6 November 1949. What the author says was he didn't get to read it because he wasn't ready. I would put it a little differently, I think. I would have said that we're going to see how the crowd interferes with him. So I would take the crowd as his need to be accepted as hair professor. And that's what's intercepting his task of transmitting this book inside himself to the outside.
How about the crowd inside himself?
Yeah, I mean, it's the reflection of his need for public approval.
Wouldn't be like unintegrated complexes that glom onto this material first and prevent him from really...
That's the way he took it. I can't say for sure. I can only tell you, I watch what I first feel when I read this stuff, and the first thing I thought was, oh, you see, there's the collective snatching his task away from him. And, you know, as Kathy said, the collective is an inner voice. Ultimately, what we are addicted to isn't public opinion, it's how our inner public opinion is manipulated by outer public opinion. Or how our need for approval is manipulated by outer public opinion. Okay, so back to 54. This is a toughie. I'm in a wooded landscape. To the left and below me is a ravine. It is dark. In the open, nature experiments are being conducted with rays and electrical currents. And nearby them are a woman and several children. As a pressing suspicion comes over me concerning the electrical supply line and cable, I wish to examine the experiments. As I begin to descend into the ravine with the women and children, I am repeatedly illuminated by blinding, blinking lights. I fear that comes from dangerous criminals. I consider it dangerous to continue and stand hesitatingly. Then from the right, the stranger enters in his familiar light, dark figure. Immediately it becomes daylight and the false electrical line is clear to see. To my astonishment, however, I find next to this cable a second one, the correct one. The criminals are not or no longer to be seen. Immediately the stranger cuts through the false cable. Then he leads us, myself, the woman, and the children, back up the hill from which we came. As we have again arrived above, he says to me, "Now I have something to show you." To my surprise, I now see a scale in front of me. In each of its pans lies a piece of wood, horizontal from back to front. I see that the left side of the scale moves down. At that, the stranger explains, "You believe now that the left pieces of wood, that left piece of wood is heavier. That is completely false. You have weighed not the weight of the wood, but its spin. And that is because of the parallel positioning of the pieces of wood. Just look." And do you remember the diagram? If you want to take a second, it's back there, page B. It says page 68. You see how there's a scale at the top? That's the top one we're talking about. And the pieces of wood are parallel. Now you rotate the left piece of wood so that it is now positioned on the left pan, positioned on the pan in a left to right direction. So he changes it 90 degrees. You can see in the second diagram. The right side of the scale immediately moves downward. So they were first not level and now they're leveling out. Laughingly, the stranger says, "Now the scale is measuring correctly and the dream becomes increasingly lighter. I awake." By the way, that dream is 15. Some of these I forgot to mark. And it's 28 November 19, 28 October, sorry, 28 October 1950. Well, we do have her correspondence, Von Franz's correspondence on this. We don't have much from her. But this is what she writes. So let's look at it carefully. The criminals are indeed blinding unconscious prejudices, as you have once described in the case of Kepler, that further the influence of archetypal ideas on the formation of concepts in physics on the one hand, while also limiting and constraining that formation on the other. That sentence itself is kind of a bear, I find. What she's saying, she's saying that behind science is an image, basically Trinitarian, so that our Newtonian physics is based on a Trinitarian model. Because the Trinitarian attitude is about cause and effect and about power. And on the one hand, that image is what is responsible for guiding the imagination of the scientist in the development of his ideas. On the other hand, it produces a very certain type of science which doesn't deal with all of life's phenomena. So that's what she said, AIDS, and what, I forget what else she says. It furthers and it limits. Now, that sounds so academic, but do you understand the personal relevance of that for Pauli and for us? See, Pauli is caught in a Trinitarian worldview everywhere. Do you understand what I mean by a Trinitarian worldview? Well, because it's an attitude that was born with the advent of Christianity. And it emphasizes a couple of things. The spirit over matter. Choice over nature. Accomplishment over being. You know, compare... I don't think it's true anymore because, you know, the civilizations have mixed so much. But say, compare the West in 1920 and India in 1920. That's the difference between a Trinitarian and a Quaternarian society. You see the difference? The one is geared to accomplishment. The other is geared to being. The one is safe for health physically, but not safe for health mentally. The other is not safe for health physically, but probably more safe for health mentally, in that no one seems to be in such a hurry. So that kind of pulling ourselves up out of inertia, which is what Christianity did positively for civilization at its advent, at its birth, is accompanied by images of God that are Trinitarian. So that's the physical world that's the view of science that Pauli is being nudged out of. And it's also the personal idea he has that he has to get out of about life, that he's in control. Trinitarian is all about control. Those of you who did the dream analysis seminar, I don't know if you remember, but the guy, when he started, when his wife started being sexual with him again, right before that, he had a dream of jumping out of an airplane and getting injured. And the airplane was, you know, it's a trinity. Fuselage and two extensions. So that's a typical challenge for people. Most of us were raised and are still pretty Trinitarian, Protestant, getting things done, being clear, making things happen. That's Trinitarian. And yet Pauli now is being put into a position where he's seen where getting things done in science has led is Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So he's being asked to reevaluate that basic substrate of life that has given risen to a type A science. And he's also being asked to examine it in his own personality. I think that's what that image is about. And there's something criminal about it. We don't see it because we're identical with it. But go to the third world and ask them how they see us, and they'll tell you about the criminal side of ourselves.
Well, and it steals the other side from us. You know, in that way it's criminal. It steals from us.
And it steals from us, yeah.
That other side.
You know, he was thriving during the period of modernism, which was a rational enlightened view that said if it's not can't be quantified, it's not real.
Yeah.
And so what it did was it created an ordered norm that totally disallowed the chaotic utter.
Yeah.
It didn't even allow it into consciousness. It was projected completely outside. And
yeah.
So that's what he's right in the thick of that transition.
Yeah, and that's the blinding prejudices are that worldview, which has allowed us to become enormously powerful and successful, but of course with limits.
The only knowledge is rational knowledge.
Right.
Nothing out of the imagination is real.
Nothing out of imagination and nothing out of the mystery of events.
Nothing out of the answer.
Mm-hmm. Right.
No reality.
I had one question.
Yeah.
If the spindles are the Trinitarian factor,
yeah.
How do they lead to the grail in the myth?
You want to get off on that?
I don't want to throw you off.
I don't mind. Well, as far as the grail goes, there's a very important detail, which when I hear populist interpretations of the grail, usually are missing. Look what happens when he gets to the grail.
He?
Galahad.
Dies.
He dies. It's not a good omen. And the same in the, you know, there's like four different, I think there's three main different versions of the grail. One's German, one's French. I think two might be French, I kind of forget. But in the one we probably know, which is the French one, Chrétien de Troyes, T-R-O-Y-E-S, when Parsifal does ask the question, whom does the grail serve? And the answer is it serves the grail king. The grail king dies. Same idea. That the redemptive moment is the death of the previous thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now the way von Franz talks about that is that the grail holds what sustains the old worldview. Does that make sense? It's a more a negative interpretation of the story.
She says more than that about the grail, though, and it's...
In its deepest sense, yes, but as it's in the story, the grail is the holder of what's precious. But what the way she takes it is what the story is telling us is that we have to see that what we consider is precious is really keeping the old worldview alive. And so the grail task is seeing how the medieval interpretation of Christianity, which is basically our interpretation of Christianity, serves to keep the old thing alive. It is not about finding the new thing. And that what has to be recognized is that fact.
And then there's another side to this interpretation, if I recall, which Jung talks about the myth of the Grail being the thing that compensates the old myth.
I don't know, Carol. I would say compensates in the sense that it shows that what needs to die.
In Zarath, in the seminars on Zarathustra, he cites the Grail as that thing which compensates the old world view as symbolized by Zarathustra of power.
However, it's containing that, it's keeping that old world view alive. That's the tragedy.
I guess I understood him to say that it contained that fourth element, which was a compensation to the old worldview.
Can you dig that out? Maybe you can come back to it.
Okay.
The Grail is a positive image of what sustains life. But ironically, what it sustains is something that needs to die. And that's what we need to see, what it is that needs to die. Then the Grail can begin to have its true function.
Well, I think that says it.
Is that say it?
I think so.
Okay. Now, see, Galahad would be like the old king. He needs to die so that the old image cannot really deal with the lower trinity. That's the whole problem. And the Grail King, if you remember, was wounded in the thigh. See, that's lower trinity stuff. That's about eroticism and sexuality.
By the barbarian.
By the barbarian. And the barbarian and the lower trinity are very close.
Chaotic other.
Chaotic other. And you could say, you know, Pali is Galahad and the Grail King. And he's getting a thigh wound. Namely, Marie-Louise von Franz. And he should have let it discombobulate him and, you know, go to her on his knees and strike up a working relationship and pay the price of the fire. Maybe his wife would have accepted that. Maybe she wouldn't have. But he might not have died at 58. That's the dilemma the poor guy was in.
You don't think he didn't have affairs with other women, though? I mean...
I think he... I don't know, to be honest with you. After he was married, I don't know. I wouldn't have been surprised if he visited brothels. See, that you can do on the sly.
That's compartmentalization.
That's compartmentalization. I don't know that for a fact, but I wouldn't be surprised. But to have a friend that you can't get rid of so easily... Okay, so that was on that first sentence. These people in the ravine... Oh, gosh, it's 2:30. Maybe that's a good place to stop anyway. So, just a quick summarize. We'll go back to the ravine. We'll go back to see what the prejudices are. Well, we've talked about that. Let's look at that a little bit more. And then we're going to try to figure out the scale image. And how the dreams are... Well, this dream, again, is trying to bring Pali to the recognition of what is false and what is real. What is real will be his feelings for von Franz and his challenge to be a new professor, so to speak. What is false is his hiding behind the need to protect pride and continuing to be hair professor.
that everybody loves.
So one more week here, and then in 4 weeks we don't meet, and then in 6 weeks we meet at Nancy's. Well, what do we do today? I'm embarrassed.
Three, four pages.
We did 3 pages. I probably we won't get through. Let's see if we can get through the end of the chapter next time. Okay, thanks. See you in two.